I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Ebola dominated the headlines as the virus spread through West Africa. While researchers are scrambling to find a vaccine, over a million children die every year from preventable diseases that we do have vaccines for. International organisations like Gavi are working to provide access to these life-saving vaccines. Cricket Nikovic, Senior Policy Associate at Results Educational Fund, joins me to talk about the challenges of vaccinating people on a global scale. But first, wielding only an empty whiskey bottle, Marshall Ledbetter broke into and took over the Florida state capitol in 1991. His list of demands included pizza, a case of beer, cigarettes, and 666 Dunkin' Donuts for the police that showed up for the standoff. After surrendering, Ledbetter entered the state's mental health system. He eventually committed suicide in 2003. I'll speak with author and sociologist Daniel M. Harrison about his book Making Sense of Marshall Ledbetter and about how the justice system handles cases of mental illness in Florida. I'm joined on the phone by Daniel M. Harrison. He's an associate professor of sociology at Lander University in Greenwood, South Carolina. He's also the author of Making Sense of Marshall Ledbetter. Daniel, thank you so much for joining me.
You are very welcome. It's my pleasure.
A bit of backstory about Marshall Ledbetter. He broke into the state capitol in 1991. This is in Tallahassee. He made a list of wild demands that night. Could you just walk me through what actually happened?
Well, basically, Marshall Ledbetter was a super bright college student at Florida State University. He actually arrived in Tallahassee in 1987. And everything seemed to be going okay for the first few months while he was there. But then he sort of got involved with this sort of crowd of somewhat student radicals, I guess you could say, and his whole worldview started to change. He had grown up in a very sort of sheltered conservative household, and Tallahassee basically blew his mind completely. He had never used drugs or alcohol before going to Florida State University, and he quickly became involved in that scene. And sort of push came to shove, and he sort of dropped out of school, and he left, and he went back home to outside of Orlando. And he came back in the fall of 1990, and in the spring of 1991, he basically went on a self-described vision quest. And after consuming psychedelic mushrooms for 23 days straight, he kind of had this vision of Bob Dobbs, who was the Church of the Subgenius deity. And he decided to sort of take over the Florida Capitol as kind of this as this big prank. He envisioned it as this big political joke. And so at about 3 o'clock in the morning on June 14th, 1991, he took a whiskey bottle and he smashed in through the doors of the Capitol. And he actually occupied the Sergeant of Arms suite. And there he found quite an exemplary stash of liquor and also some half-decent cigars. And he locked himself inside. He issued a rather crazy demands note, including 666 Dunkin' Donuts, an extra large Gumby's pizza, and a case of beer, and a carton of cigarettes, and meetings with Jello Biafra and Flavor Flav and Ice Cube and members of the American Indian Movement and this sort of a thing. And he, at least from my perspective, he viewed it as I said, as kind of this big joke, this big sort of a prank. He was involved with some other pranksters at Florida State University called the Monarchy Party, and he was trying to one-up their sort of strange kind of comedy. The police didn't really see it that way, and he was taken into custody after his demands were ostensibly read live on CNN, and he was then given a psychiatric evaluation. They declared him insane, and eventually he was sent off to the state hospital in Chattahoochee for 6 months evaluation.
So what happened after that? I mean, was he imprisoned? Was he confined to a mental institution?
He was declared insane during the time of the offense, and also he was labeled as bipolar, you know, manic depressive. And he was sent to Florida State Hospital, Chattahoochee. They didn't really know what to make of him there. And he clearly did not want to be there. He did not think that he had a mental illness at that particular time. And he refused treatment. They wanted to prescribe him lithium, which is one of the standard treatments for depression, manic depression in particular. And he said that he would commit suicide if he was treated. He did not want lithium. And so that ended up being sort of a thorn in the side of the Florida justice system. And although the state does have the power to treat people forcibly and voluntarily, there's different procedures that need to go through. So there was going to be a hearing looking at the constitutional issues involved. And then Ledbetter actually managed to escape, albeit briefly, from the Chattahoochee Mental Hospital. Ironically, that escape attempt seemed to have gotten him out of there a little bit early. But the story is somewhat of a tragic one because if you read the book or if the listeners read the book, they'll know that he was sort of in and out of mental hospitals for the rest of his life, which wasn't much longer after that, about 10 years, I guess, because he died at 33. He committed suicide, and that's kind of one of the interesting things that, that drew me to this case was that it starts off as being kind of this very humorous, student of a story of a college student that decides to take over the state capitol building. But there's a very dark, very tragic element to it as well, and much of what I talk about is sort of the plight of young people, especially sort of overachieving young people in society today, mm-hmm. and how many of them don't make it. Many of them burn out before their time.
You describe a situation where he was exposed to this radical scene, and it kind of, I guess, tripped a few switches in his mind. But what was Tallahassee like in the late 80s, early 90s? Was it really that wild and free?
Well, I would say it certainly was a little bit more wild and free than it is today. There was a sizable contingent of sort of countercultural students there associated with this Monarchy Party, which was this satirical student government party, and they liked to dress up in funny costumes and issue proclamations in strange accents, and they put out these really hilarious student newspapers, poking fun at the administration and poking fun at the fraternity-dominated, social scene and everything else. And remember that this was the late 80s, and there were many anniversary sort of celebrations of, 60s radicalism. This was the 20th anniversary of bands like, the Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band album, and that sort of a thing. And there were some other people in the popular culture, like Timothy Leary, who was around in the 60s, and he sort of had a resurgence in a career. And so I would say that it wasn't like the entire campus was wild and free, but Florida State University was known as the Berkeley of the South during the 1960s, and it has sort of had a small but significant contingent of counterculturals for quite a long time.
Mm-hmm. And you describe some of the wild and crazy demands he made. It sounds like he was organizing a music festival there, Jello Biafra, Flavor Flav, Ice Cube. Did any of his demands make it to the ears of any of those people?
Well, funnily enough, they did. Jello Biafra, who I'm not sure if any of your listeners, well, they probably do know about Jello Biafra, but he was the lead singer of the Dead Kennedys, mm-hmm. Back in the day, which was a very influential punk band based out of San Francisco. And he had basically given up on Dead Kennedys, but he was going around the country doing these spoken word tours and shows. And he was performing in Tallahassee one day. This was after Ledbetter had been institutionalized for the first time. And some of Marshall's friends showed up and said, hey, you need to read this list of demands. You're mentioned in it. And Jello, I spoke to him, actually, and he was intrigued immediately. And he actually ended up writing a song called The Ballad of Marshall Ledbetter about the incident with his band Lord, which was also featured one of the guys from a Ministry, Al Jurgensen, who was fairly well known in the music industry as well. So,
right.
As far as I know, at this particular moment, Jello Biafra was the only person who knew that his demands were, or knew that he was listed in the demands note.
Mm-hmm.
Lemmy was also mentioned of the band Motorhead, and as you mentioned, Flavor Flav, Ice Cube, leaders of the American Indian movement.
How long did the standoff last for?
The standoff lasted for about 8 hours. So he broke in at about 3 o'clock in the morning. He was in the Sergeant of Arms suite by about 4 in the morning, and then by about noon it was all over. He said that he would be released if his demands were broadcast live on CNN, and they actually faked the CNN news broadcast and piped it through the closed-circuit television system in the Capitol building. They actually had a real CNN stringer, a freelance reporter by the name of Mike Vasalinda, who read the demands, quote unquote, you know, live on CNN, and Ledbetter saw them, and after he saw them, he gave himself up.
Mm-hmm. How do you think law enforcement, the authorities, would handle a situation like that today?
That's a really good question, and it's up for some debate. I did speak to Sheriff Larry Campbell, the sheriff of Leon County, and he told me on the phone that nothing would be different, and the police officers routinely deal with slightly mentally unstable people who are locked inside buildings and so on and so forth. But you do have situations like the Myron May case that happened just the other week at Florida State University, where he was shot dead and he didn't live to see the tale. Of course, the difference was that Ledbetter did not have a gun. He did make some references to hostages and hostiles and weapons and that sort of a thing. So as much as I would like to think that that Ledbetter would not have faced any harm, I think there's probably a decent chance that he would have been killed.
And I guess not all the facts are known in the Myron May case you reference, but there's a question about Myron May's state of mind, of course, when he went to FSU and started shooting and was ultimately shot and killed by the police there.
Yep.
So the issues that you're talking about in your book are still around today, the issue of bright young people in high-pressure situations and what can happen to sort of tip them over the edge.
Exactly. Precisely. And I think that the important thing from a sociological perspective is to sort of look at the underlying social context in which both of these events occurred. And I think it's important to realize that mental health doesn't just come out of nowhere. It comes out of some sort of social milieu. And in Ledbetter's case, he was sort of flailing. He was sort of foundering in school. A lot of the students that he had gone to school with, friends of his, were graduating. They were getting on with his lives. But because he had failed out once before, he was behind them. And I think he was looking for some way to regain a little bit of status. I think he was trying to impress a girl that he was somewhat interested in at the time. He was trying to compete with the Monarchy Party in a lot of their crazy antics, and he was trying to ultimately, I think, try to have this sense of recognition of validation. Going through a very difficult time. I think all people in their early 20s can kind of relate to that angst. Mm-hmm. This idea of I really don't know what I want to do yet with my life, and what will I be, and all this sort of a thing. And in Myron May's case, I think we need to look at the fact that he was going through bankruptcy. He had moved from a law firm in Houston, making a good deal of money, to a job in New Mexico, which wasn't paying as much. And so he was, there were some economic or financial issues there, what he was grappling with. He was an African-American in a profession, the legal profession, which has very few African-American lawyers in it. And he was one of this high achieving people, and like I said, it's too early to know too much of the case, but I think that it's important to not just sort of use the label of mental illness to dismiss all other interpretations or reasons for why people might end up in situations like this.
Well, coming back to that question of mental illness, though, specifically in Florida, what kind of a job do we do in this state of helping people who are in situations like that of Marshall Ledbetter?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and I would say that it's a little bit mixed. There are some police departments, like in Winter Haven, for example, which practice what's called the Memphis model scheme for dealing with the mentally ill, and this is where police officers take these classes in crisis management, and it instructs them on how to deal with mentally ill people in crisis situations. It teaches them to be on the lookout for certain signs and symptoms and things like that. When you look at the funding for the mentally ill in Florida, it's woefully inadequate, I would say. And many of the hospitals have become privatized. There's a big debate in society about whether the privatization of mental hospitals or prisons, for example, or jails is a good thing. And I would say generally that it is not. And then you have to look at the issues of staffing and the educational credentials of the people who are working at some of these institutions. And at least in Ledbetter's case, the first time he was in Chattahoochee, it seems like he got a fair amount of decent positive care and had some doctors and other people who were really advocating for him. When he went back the second time, it's a little less clear. He managed to make telephone calls to a former professor at Florida State University. How he made these calls, no one really knows, but they were repeated. So I don't know if he got the cell phone from somebody who was working there, but it indicates that they weren't running a very tight ship. And his remarks about the G. Pierce Wood Hospital down in Arcadia was just an absolute nightmare. I mean, mm-hmm. the scene that he describes there was absolutely horrific. I mean, female inmates prostituting themselves for cigarettes, you know, fights and just overcrowding and basically warehousing the mentally ill. In our society, I think we've seen a shift from the institutionalization of the mentally ill, which basically lasted up until the 1980s, to a deinstitutionalization movement. We have largely Ronald Reagan to thank for that. And so now many of the people who formerly might have been in more of long-term institutions or hospitals, really there's no place for them to go anymore. And so we treat them by using, very powerful psychotropic drugs, but we don't provide much structure to sort of help them through just the day-to-day activities of their lives, or to help them come to terms with what the drugs might be doing to them. And so I think we've sort of gone, the pendulum has shifted a little bit too much to a lack of structure, and I would like to bring back into the conversation perhaps the idea that we need to have more of what we used to call the halfway houses. So these were places between sort of regular society and between sort of the full-blown mental asylums which we had in the past.
I've been speaking to Daniel M. Harrison. He's an associate professor of sociology at Lander University in Greenwood. We've been talking about his book, Making Sense of Marshall Ledbetter. Marshall Ledbetter, of course, broke into the state capitol in 1991 in Tallahassee, made a list of wild demands. He was later arrested and died some 10 years later. Thank you very much for speaking to us, Daniel.
Thank you, Matthew. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. You can join the conversation online on Facebook and Twitter. Archived interviews are available at WMFE.org or on WMFE's smartphone app, available for iOS and Android. Coming up after the break, a conversation with Cricket Nikovic, Senior Policy Associate at Results, about vaccinations. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. I'm joined in the studio by Senior Policy Associate at Results Educational Fund, Cricket Nikovic. Cricket, thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks, Matthew. Glad to be here.
Well, your organization is gearing up for the Vaccine Alliance. It's also known as Gavi. Can you tell me a little bit about that program?
Sure. Gavi, the Vaccines Alliance, was founded in the year 2000, and it really is a partnership between developing countries, donor nations, the World Bank, UNICEF, and other international organizations to bring access to vaccines to the poorest countries in the world. And since 2000, they've been able to immunize almost 500 million children, which will save over 6 million lives.
What are the diseases you are looking to immunize against?
Sure. Gavi actually works on about 11 different vaccines, everything from measles, cholera, but also some of the newer vaccines, which are the really exciting pneumococcal and rotavirus vaccines. Pneumococcal vaccine preventing pneumonia, mm-hmm. and rotavirus preventing some severe cases of diarrhea. And these are exciting because pneumonia and diarrhea are still, to this day, some of the leading killers of kids under the age of 5.
Are some of these diseases also making a comeback in the United States?
Sure. Well, measles, of course, with some vaccine hesitancy. There have been more cases of measles reported this year than in the past 20 years. Mm-hmm. And you have cases of whooping cough, also on the rise here in the U.S., and really that comes down to access to vaccines and providing vaccines, and when we have what we call herd immunity, when a larger number of kids are vaccinated, over 80% usually, 90% is even better, you have herd immunity against mm-hmm. these infectious diseases. And when we see vaccine rates go down, that herd immunity is lost. And it's the same internationally. If not having access to vaccines some of these poorest countries has really hindered the use of being able to survive to the age of five for kids who don't have these access to vaccines.
Is it just a matter of access in some of the countries you're talking about, or is it also education? Like, is there, you talk about vaccine hesitancy in the United States, but what about in some of the countries where you're trying to get people access to vaccines for a start? I mean, do you also have to educate them that it's a good idea to get yourself and your kids immunized against measles, for example?
Certainly. Well, measles is an interesting case. In Tanzania, a few years ago, there was an outbreak of measles where over 8,000 children had measles cases, and it was a huge loss of death as well. Knowing that measles was a leading killer and having a huge catch-up campaign in the country actually has spurred huge increases in coverage rates for measles, mm-hmm. and over 90% of coverage rates for measles in Tanzania. And it's really leading to the knowledge that vaccines are working. And that's something where if you've gone for years in your country and as a mom, right, you've seen years upon years of your neighbor's kids dying of things as simple as diarrhea, and now know that there's access to a vaccine, rotavirus vaccine, that can prevent some of these severest cases of diarrhea, you know that we have lines out the door of moms going to try and get access to these new vaccines. Mm-hmm. So education is definitely a key component, but just knowing that there are these new vaccines and having the ability to get them is something that is really driving up coverage rates for these new vaccines.
So talk a little bit about this year's meeting. Where are you meeting, and what kind of goals does Gavi have?
Sure. So this year in May, Gavi set out a new 5-year strategy. And this 5-year strategy actually is supporting 300 million children getting access to immunization, and that which will save between 5 to 6 million lives. They're asking for donors to come together in January in Berlin to really lay down funding for this strategy. The goal is to raise $7.5 billion from all donors. Then the U.S. is actually the fourth largest donor to Gavi. We're behind the U.K., the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and Norway. So we're fourth leading donor for Gavi, and we're asking that the U.S. be a leader at this table, coming together in Berlin with President Merkel actually leading this this replenishment conference, and just mm-hmm. taking a pledge of $1 billion over 4 years to this replenishment conference.
It sounds like a lot of money.
It's actually a very small amount of our global health budget, which is even a lesser amount of international development assistance that we give. Mm-hmm. Gavi has, over time, we've actually increased our support for Gavi. This year, for example, both the House and the Senate have allocated $200 million for the Gavi and access to immunizations for fiscal year 2015. So a $1 billion pledge, that's kind of the down payment for this first 4-year pledge that we're asking for. And it's really just incremental increases over the next 4 years.
I guess if you talk about diseases on a global scale, the one that's sucking up all the air out of the headlines is Ebola, right? So the forefront of the media when it comes to talking about diseases, and I guess there's no vaccination yet, but there's talk of that as well. If there was an Ebola vaccine developed, I mean, how long would it take to roll that out?
I'm not going to be able to answer how long it would take to roll out. I think the development process itself is a lengthy process for any vaccine. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where Gavi steps in. Gavi actually works with manufacturers of vaccines, the pharmaceutical industries themselves, and with the countries that are high-burden countries to really make some negotiations around costing and the rollout and timing of new vaccines. As you may or may not know that introducing a new vaccine into a country requires everything from storage spaces in the, you know, city centers of the capitals to access to refrigeration in the furthest most point, because you have to keep a vaccine most often has to be kept cold across every point of transportation. And again, also transportation, the roads to get those vaccines down the pipe. So Gavi actually works with countries to think through readiness and preparedness to really get countries prepared with everything from training of healthcare workers to really thinking about that transportation and that cold chain to keep the refrigeration across every point of transport, but also works with the manufacturing companies and the pharmaceutical companies about how much do those cost, and really helping to shape the market to make sure that they know, pharmaceutical companies know, that there is a buyer down the pipe, these countries that are going to be able to take on the vaccine. Mm-hmm. So Gavi would really... has already said that they would step in around an Ebola vaccine and help to work and use its, you know, its comparative advantage of having this kind of background.
But it would it's a long way down the track.
It'll take a while, yeah.
I mean, when you talk about a disease like Ebola, it's basically been dominating headlines for quite some time now. Does that kind of hinder people thinking about other vaccines which are already there and diseases which are preventable if only people would be able to get access to those vaccines?
I think that a case like Ebola crisis just really opens up our eyes around where are our weaknesses and around health systems. And when we think about routine immunization systems being the backbone of a working health system, it kind of gives us an idea of where are we missing opportunities and where can we continue to invest? I think something like Ebola has really taken off in the headlines, but it's also reopened the American public's eyes around these are issues that are global, but they're so local. This could be in our backyard. And so really thinking about how do we invest now and using the momentum around Ebola to really bring about awareness around all the issues of global health is something that we've got to continue to push, because Ebola is just one part of a bigger global health question.
I've been speaking to Senior Policy Associate at Results Educational Fund, Cricket Nikovich. Cricket, thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.